In the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 14, God tells Israel, because all those men which have seen my glory, my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swore unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoked me see it. Israel stood on the eastern edge of the land of Canaan, the land that God had promised to them, to Moses, to Joseph, to Jacob, to Isaac, and Abraham. And yet, as they now stood beside the promised land, God declared that all the adults of Israel would die and would not enter the land promised by him. And his judgment upon them was because of their continued rebellion against him. 10 times they provoked God. 10 times they rebelled, complained, doubted, and murmured. We saw the first several of those 10 times last week. The Israelites stood on the shores of the Red Sea, saw the army of Egypt pursuing them, and cried out against God and Moses. God delivered them by parting the waters of the Red Sea and then crushing Pharaoh's army in the sea. And 3 days later, they murmured because they had no drinkable water. God provided water for them. And a month later, they were again complaining because this time they had no food. God gave them a miraculous food, manna, on the ground every day for them to eat. And God gave them this food, and he gave them specific instructions for it. But they disobeyed and attempted to gather it as they saw fit. They continued their journey until they reached a place called Rephidim. There they were thirsty and provoked God by complaining again. Then Moses had just brought them all out into the wilderness to die. God miraculously gave them water pouring out of a rock, and God in his faithfulness continued to provide for his people. He gave them victory over their enemies. And after leaving the camp at Rephidim, they journeyed to the region of Mount Sinai. And in the 3rd month after their departure from Egypt, Israel set up camp around the same mountain where God first spoke to Moses, commanding him to return to Egypt and lead the Israelites out of bondage into the promised land. And there at Sinai, many, many remarkable things happened. God assured Israel, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then shall ye be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. In Exodus 19, verse 6, God promises, ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. And then in verse 8, all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So God said, if you obey me, you will be a kingdom unto me, a kingdom of priests, and I will give you this land that I have promised you. I'll fulfill all of these promises to you. And they said, all the Lord's spoken, we'll do. We will obey. And so God then told the Israelites to prepare themselves to see the presence of God and to hear the voice of God. And when all the preparations were made, God came down to the top of Mount Sinai. And God's glory was so great, so terrible on the mountain that the Israelites were terrified. They saw the mountain smoking as if it was on fire. They saw terrible lightnings and heard many thunders. They heard the blast of trumpets and they ran from the mountain. They stood a long way off and they told Moses to go talk to God for them. Moses said, fear not, for God has come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. Moses went up onto Mount Sinai, went up into the presence of God. There on Mount Sinai, God gave to Moses the law. This began with the giving of the Ten Commandments, and then a longer summary of the law. And this summary really was the gist of the covenant that God was making with Israel, and that Israel was making with God. And in Exodus 24, Moses returned to Israel and brought with them the summary and read it to the entire congregation. And in Exodus 24, verse 7, he said he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has said will we do and be obedient." And so they have said, early on, we will obey. Now Moses has said, here's basically what God is going to require of you. And they said, we will obey. And so Moses now goes back up into the mountain. And to the Israelites there watching, it seemed as if the whole mountain was consumed in fire. And for 40 days, Moses stayed on the mountain, receiving from God the entirety of the law. God gave laws about how to worship Him, how to treat one another, how to respond to the people in Canaan, how to treat others from other nations, how to organize their camp in the wilderness, how to build the tabernacle, what to eat, how to deal with civil complaints, how to punish criminal actions. He gave an entire body of law that directed them in everything that they were to do. But when the Israelites saw that Moses was on the mountain for a very long time, they were afraid that apparently he disappeared or died or some such thing. And so they came to Aaron. And in Exodus 32, we see that they came to Aaron and demanded he make them gods. And they didn't know what would happen to Moses. And so they sought idols that would go before them and lead them victorious into Canaan. And Aaron commanded them to bring to him all the golden earrings, which he then melted down and formed into the image of a calf. And in Exodus 32, the Israelites saw this, and they said, "These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." And in Exodus 32, verse 5, Aaron saw it, and he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." And so the next morning, they brought offering to their idol. This idol they had made, and I want to be clear here, I don't think they're making an idol of, you know, an Egyptian god. Aaron says, "This is tomorrow's a feast to Jehovah." They have made this idol and said, "This is the God that brought us out of Egypt. This is Jehovah." And they came the next morning and they made offerings to them, and they ate and they drank and they played. They worshiped. They had this great festival of worship to their idol. And God commanded Moses to return off the mountain. He says in verse 7, "Go, get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereunto, and have said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people. Behold, it is a stiff-necked people." God has said they are wicked and they are stubborn in their wickedness. And Moses went down from the mountain. He had with him the two tablets of stone containing the summary of the law of God. And when Moses reached the camp of the Israelites, he threw down these tablets written by God, shattering them in a graphic imitation of Israel's own breaking of the law. And Moses destroyed the idol that they had made. He questioned Aaron, who tried to lay the responsibility on the people. And so Moses went outside the encampment and called those who had not abandoned the true worship of God to come out to him out of the camp. And that day, 3,000 people died in Israel because of the nation's idolatry. And then something truly horrible happened. God commanded Moses to move the tabernacle out of its spot in the middle of the Israelites' camp. You see, what had happened there at Sinai, God had given commandment about making of a tabernacle. That was where God's presence was known and seen. That was where they went to worship. And God tells Moses, take this tabernacle outside the camp. No longer was the worship of God and the presence of God in the middle of the nation. Now it is outside. Whenever anyone wanted to go sacrifice to God, he had to leave Israel and go to the tabernacle. God removed himself, distanced himself from his people. He promised still to lead them to Canaan. He promised to drive them out of drive out the nations before them, but he was not going to go in their midst. And this terrified Moses, as well it should. Moses pled with God to go with them. And God responded to Moses' plea in a great act of mercy. He promised to go with his people. And then in Exodus chapter 33, Moses makes an audacious, bold request. He says to God, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. He's basically saying, God, let me see you. Now, I don't think Moses knew fully what he was asking and the ramifications of what he was asking, but God was gracious to them. And he says in verse 19, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And he said, God said to Moses, thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. God said, I will do this which you ask, but you cannot see my full glory. So God told Moses to make to him two tablets, like those that Moses had broken, to bring them up into Mount Sinai. Moses obeyed and went back up into the mountain to write again in stone the law that God had given. And God descended again on Mount Sinai, just as he had done before. And he placed Moses in a small cave, a cleft, a notch in the hillside. And he covered Moses so that Moses would not be slain by the sight of the glory of God. And as God's glory passed by, in verse 6, he proclaimed to Moses his name, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and to the fourth generation. And Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth in worship. And he said, if now I have found grace in thy sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray thee, go among us. For it is a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and our sin and take us for thine inheritance. Moses worships God again, asking God to go in their midst. God in his grace does what he has said, does what Moses asked. And following this incredible event on Mount Sinai, Moses went back down to the Israelites and now begins to teach them the law of God. And Israel stayed camped by the base of Mount Sinai for the better part of a year. So the rest of the book of Exodus is taken up with the instructions for building the tabernacle and then the completion of the tabernacle. The book of Leviticus describes in great detail God's commands regarding worship of Him. So much of Leviticus is taken up with teaching about sacrifices and feasts, about the priest and about the laws of ceremonial uncleanness. Leviticus establishes the descendants of Jacob's son Levi, we call them the Levites, as the family from which all the priests must come. And it establishes Aaron as the high priest over the nation. And then we go to the book of Numbers, and it begins with a census of the Israelites, and then some further instructions regarding their entrance into the land of Canaan. And so for 10 months, Israel camped by Mount Sinai, building the tabernacle and its furniture, learning the law, and setting in order all that was necessary to worship God as He had commanded. Exactly 1 year after the Israelites saw God deliver them from the land of Egypt by the slaughter of the eldest in every Egyptian household, 1 year later they celebrated Passover again. This time they celebrated it not in their homes of slavery, but in tents pitched in the wilderness within sight of the place where they had received the law of God. They celebrated the feast of Passover and the feast of unleavened bread. And when the feast days were ended, the glory of God moved off the tabernacle of God and began to lead them on the last leg of their journey to Canaan. And as they journeyed, the Israelites would set up camp wherever God's glory rested over the tabernacle, and they would continue their journey whenever God's glory went in front of them to lead the way. And then in Numbers chapter 11, we find them just a few days into their journey, and they're beginning to complain again. In Numbers 11 verse 4, they say, "Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away. There's nothing at all beside this manna." The Israelites continued complaining. And they angered the Lord. They frustrated Moses. God heard the complaints of the nation, and He sent them flesh. But it was not a blessing to them. God sent quail to them, so much so that it covered the ground. It describes it as being 3 foot high of quail. Anywhere all around the outside of Israel, the outside of the camp, for a whole day's journey, so as far as you could walk for miles, was just layer upon layer upon layer of quail. And they had it so much, not for 1 day or 2 days, but for an entire month. And it says in verse 20, "Until it comes out your nostrils, and it be loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord, and have wept before Him, saying, why came we forth out of Egypt?" So God afflicted the Israelites with a plague of quails. They received the meat they demanded, but it was no longer pleasant to them. And then in Numbers chapter 13, we see them at the borders of Canaan. God leads them there, and He tells Moses in verse 2, "Send thou men that they may search the land which I give unto the children of Israel." And then it goes through and it tells us of these 12 men that Moses selected, one from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And these men journeyed into the land of Canaan. This was the land that God had promised them. This is the land God had told Jacob would be his. This is the land that God told Isaac would be his. This is the land that God told Abraham would be his. This is the land that it has been over 400 years since God first made the promise. This is a land that God delivered them out of Egypt to bring them into. They are now on the shores of this land, and these 12 men go in to discover the land, to search it out, and they found it was a beautiful and an abundant land. They found clusters of grapes so large they had to be carried on a pole between two men. They found pomegranates and figs. They came back to the nation and the Israelites, and they told them it was a land that flows with milk and honey. It's a beautiful land. However, the land was not empty. You say in verse 28, "Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land. And the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. And the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan." They say, there's all these mighty people that fill this land. They control it. We cannot do it. And at these words, the nation was agitated. But Caleb, one of the 12 spies, calmed the people. He says in verse 30, and I love Caleb's attitude, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." Let's go. What are we talking about? Let's go. Let's go take the land. But the other men, the 10 of the spies that went up with them, said, "We are not able. We can't go up against these people. They're stronger than we are." They say, and then in verse 33, "And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. And so we were in their sight." They say, these men are huge. They are giants. We'll see later, we read of Goliath, who was of this race of giants. These men were, it's not mere hyperbole, it's not a simple exaggeration when they say they are giant. These were genuinely large men, mighty warriors. And all of Israel, chapter 14, lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. They murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and they said, "Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God that we had died in the wilderness." He said, "It's far better to die here than to go into Canaan. It's far better to go back into slavery than to attempt to conquer Canaan." So they said in verse 4, "Let us make a captain. Let us return into Egypt. Let's elect a new leader. Let's go back to bondage." And Caleb and Joshua, verse 6, two of these spies pled with the people to not do such a foolish, foolish thing. They say in verse 7, "The land which we pass through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, and He will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey, only rebel not ye against the Lord. Neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is parted from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not." And so the nation went to the polls, and they voted against Caleb and Joshua. And all the congregation bade stone them with stones. They said, "We don't want anything to do with this." God spoke to Moses. God's presence, His glory, came out from in front of the tabernacle and kind of interrupts the whole proceeding. And God says to Moses, and I think God says this in the hearing of all of Israel, "How long will this people provoke me, and how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have showed among them?" And He threatens then to destroy them. Moses pled with God not to destroy the nation, but to pardon them for their continued sin. Down in verse 20, the Lord said, "I have pardoned according to thy word. But as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely They shall not see the land which I swear unto them, unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoked me see it. God said, I will pardon the nation. I will not destroy it entirely, but this generation that has rebelled over and over and over again will not receive my promise. He goes on and says, I will give my promise to their children. They will receive it, and I will utterly wipe out this generation that had rebelled. And so God commanded Moses to turn around and go back to the wilderness between the forks of the Red Sea. Numbers chapters 1 and 2 are a census. I'm not going to read them. I know if you read through the Bible, this is one of those places where you tend to bog down a little bit, because it is a list of names and of families. The families are all recounted, the number of them, the number of men in each household is told. And all of that is included. It's not just a historical document that's there for interest for those that like ancient censuses. It is there as a witness against those who saw God's might time and time again. It is there as a witness of him that refused to trust him, that refused to obey them. So at the end of Numbers chapter 14 in verse 28, God says, as truly as I live, saith the Lord, as you have spoken in mine ear, so will I do to you. You said it was better to die in the wilderness? Fine, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. And all that were numbered of you, according to your whole number, those 603,550 men who stood before the mount of the Lord, swore to obey the Lord, were numbered in the beginning of Numbers, every one of them except two, Caleb and Joshua, died without entering the land because of their rebellion. He says, verse 30, doubtless ye shall not come into the land concerning which I swear to make you dwell therein. He says it again in verse 32, as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. Your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years. He goes on and continues to lay out their judgments. And God did just as he said. All of these men, all of these adults who rebelled against God were destroyed. They never saw the promises. And it's just as last week, there's a part of this where we look at this and we are mystified at a people that can see God's power and glory in such obvious display. They can see his victory. They can every day walk outside and pick up manna off the ground that wasn't there the night before, and they know it is from God. They can tell of, because it was a year ago, they can tell of all the plagues in Egypt. They can tell of how they were delivered. They can tell of the Red Sea. They see all these things, and they get to the land of Canaan and say, nope, can't do that. It's too much. And we see that, and there's a point where we're mystified. And yet, these things are not given just to amaze us with how stubborn the Israelites were. Not at all are they given for that purpose. And we see the tragedy here of the Israelites' rebellion against God, and it's another sober warning to us. In fact, go to Hebrews chapter 3. Because the author of Hebrews takes the Israelites' rebellion in the wilderness and he makes direct and definite application to the believers today. And he warns them and warns us against an evil heart of unbelief. I mean, what do we learn from this really tragic and sad tale of doubt and fear, faithlessness and rebellion? I mean, how does the Israelites' folly in the wilderness affect us this week? Well, part of what it says, verse 12 of Hebrews chapter 3, teaches us to be on the lookout. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. He says, beware, watch out, be cautious. It's much the same thing as what we saw last week in 1 Corinthians 12 or 10:12. Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall. This is not an instruction to live in fear that by maybe some accident of yours that your salvation will be lost. It is not at all that. It is a warning to not live in presumption. Do not presume that because you are an attender of church and a religious person that everything is fine with you. You may have heard truth, you may know truth, but if you do not believe and obey the truth, it will do you no good. You will fail as surely as the Israelites did in the wilderness. And so he says, beware. And then verse 13, he says, but exhort one another daily. He says, be careful about one another. Be concerned with one another. Be encouraging one another. Be provoking one another. Be attentive to one another. There's really the Israelites we see, that to some extent, I think we see the dangers of the peer pressure. The whole nation crying out against this, carrying those alone who might have followed the leadership of Joshua and Caleb and Moses. We must attend to one another, pressuring and provoking each other to righteousness. And this is Hebrews chapter 10. Provoke one another to love and to good work. And we do with this. We must do this because sin is a deceitful thing. He says we do this lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. I mean, have you been noticing? Did you notice as we were going through that how often the Israelites said they would prefer to return to slavery in Egypt? How many times it would be better if we died here? Why don't we just all go back? I mean, we realize, I think we have to recognize that there's, I mean, if you actually said, okay, fine, go back, they'd be if they went back, they would soon be complaining again and saying, oh, we should have stayed in the wilderness. But it's just the folly of sin. They thought onions and garlic and slavery was better than the promises of God in the wilderness. Because of the deceitfulness of sin. It goes back, and at least it calls in my mind, the story of Jacob and Esau. He comes in, he is famished from being out hunting all day. He thinks he's on the point of starvation, and Jacob says, fine, I will give you this bean soup I've been making if you'll sell me your birthright. If you will sell to me your right to the promises of God that were made to our father and grandfather, you can have a bowl of beans. And Esau said, sounds like a good deal to me. It's yours. And again, we look back on that with hindsight and say, well, that was silly. How could you do that? And yet in the midst of it, sin is an incredibly destructive, deceitful thing. In the midst of it, our eyes are blinded by our own desires, by the promises of whatever it is that sin is offering. And we lose sight of the things that are really worthwhile. And we need to be careful for one another, encouraging and provoking one another, lest we be ensnared in the deceits of sin. And then that heart that is trapped in sin is soon hardened, becomes calloused and numbed to the conviction of the Holy Spirit. And so we look at this, and we don't look at the Israelites, and we must never look back at them and say, boy, I'm glad we don't act like that. We must look back at them and remember the sinful heart that dwells in them is the same as the sinful heart that dwells in me. I mean, must be careful. I must be on my guard. And then, chapter 4, verse 1, The author of Hebrews says, let us therefore fear. Not just a general fear. Don't walk through, I don't think he's saying, walk through your Christian life afraid that suddenly it's not going to turn out as God has promised, that it's all going to go wrong somehow. But rather, I think the emphasis here is fear God. Fear God and believe His Word. The Israelites saw the people of Canaan, and they got all this turned around backwards. They feared the Canaanites and doubted God. They believed the evil report of the 10 faithless spies instead of believing the promises of God. And this incident, this account of the Israelites warns us to walk by faith. As has been seen and shown and will be shown again and again and again, God is faithful. God is able to do all He promised. I mean, what is more remarkable than a million people walking through the middle of the Gulf of Suez? The incredible power that God displayed in dividing that body of water so they could walk through with walls of water on either side of them. He's shown His faithfulness time and time and time again. And He will do all He has told us that He will do. He will keep all His promises. Now, I need to give a quick warning here, because we sometimes get ourselves into trouble when we want God to do something He never promised. The Israelites demanded flesh. God didn't promise they would have all the quail and whatever other flesh they wanted to eat. He promised to give them manna every day. He promised to give them their needs. They wanted more. And when God did not give them more than He had promised, they complained against Him. They doubted Him. And so do not demand that God give you that which He has never promised. But do not doubt that God will always give what He has promised. And as you believe God, you fear Him. I mean, really, there's a legitimate point in this. When we look at these things and we see the holiness and the justice of God, we kind of glossed over them through these, but there have been horrible punishments meted out on the Israelites during these times of rebellion. They didn't walk through unscathed. God punished them. He chastened His people. And He does so most notably when they're on the shores of Canaan, as He turns them back into the wilderness and says, you will not receive. You will die in the wilderness. God is long-suffering. He is compassionate, but He will chasten. So we fear God and we keep His commandments. And these things are written. They're written as a testimony to Joshua and to the children of these Israelites that died in the wilderness. They were written as a witness to them, but they are written as a testimony and a warning to us today as well. And so we look back and we see these disappointing, bleak passages of Scripture. And we look at the failures of the Israelites that we may learn from them. We may learn to avoid the sins of the fear of man, doubt of God. So I would say again, just very simply, fear God, believe Him.